Funding for the Think Podcast comes from TCU, where researchers strive to develop sustainable solutions to protect the world's fresh water supply. You can learn more at endeavors.tcu.edu. Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
In 2015, the Federal Communications Commission took decisive action on net neutrality. The new rules meant internet service providers, companies like Comcast, Verizon, and AT&T, couldn't block or throttle legal web traffic, couldn't slow down the delivery of content linked to their competitors, or speed up streams produced by companies willing to pay extra. Last month, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai suspended those rules. So what will the end of net neutrality mean for the way we live online? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Clint Finley writes for Wired magazine about telecommunications and technology law. He's been carefully following the debates over net neutrality, what the actual effect of the change might be on regular users, and whether the now suspended regulations were unfair to the companies that sell us access to the web. He joins us now to explain what's new and talk about the likelihood that Congress might override the FCC to require net neutrality by law. Clint, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, I want to start with this with apologies for the many people who already are up to speed on this. When you need to explain net neutrality to someone who maybe hasn't lived their entire life on the internet, your grandma, how do you explain what it is and why it matters?
Well, I think the way you explained it earlier is really good. It's just the idea that an internet service provider, so that could be a wireless one like Verizon or a cable company like Comcast or Charter, the idea is that these companies shouldn't be able to discriminate against or block certain content, whether that's because they want to promote their own services or whether it's because they want to allow certain companies to pay extra to get priority access to consumers. So the idea is that they should be a neutral arbiter in terms of allowing content to flow through their networks.
Who are the stakeholders most affected by the presence or the absence of neutrality regulations? Is it these companies that produce a lot of content to go online, or is it people like you and me just using the internet?
Well, I'd say it's both. So obviously, the companies that are directly affected by the regulations are the big internet service providers like Comcast and Verizon. But it affects consumers in the long run in terms of what we can access on the internet, because And the other people it affects are smaller companies, educators, nonprofits, organizations that don't necessarily have a lot of money to pay to subsidize the connections that people have to their services. So, for example, if Comcast ends up slowing down all video to everyone who doesn't pay extra for it, what's that going to end up doing to people who want to watch streaming lectures for an online course? You know, there's a lot of potential side effects to this that we really don't know how it's going to play out yet.
Is it video content and streaming content that is most vulnerable here, or could there also be slower delivery of just like a text page?
So, yeah, I think it's going to be video, because video is the thing that's right now most sensitive to changes in speeds. A text page, in terms of slowing it down, text loads so fast these days that it would have to be a really significant crimp on a connection to really make a change there. However, there's the question of blocking it, or whether, say, a company could block a website that's critical of their service or their policies. So there is the question of whether things that aren't necessarily video or audio content will be affected by this.
So there aren't rules against companies discriminating literally based on content, not even just the origin source.
Correct. The old rules are still in the books, but in about 2 months, those are going to go away. So and once those go away, there won't be any explicit rules. So the FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, argues that existing antitrust laws, anti-competitive regulations, would be enough to protect consumers from essentially the worst harms that that could be expected. But you know, we don't really know how that would play out.
So who enforces antitrust laws? Is that the Federal Trade Commission, the Department of Justice?
Both of those two organizations, correct, depending on the context. So the FCC is now saying that they expect the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, to take over internet-related activities.
All right, Clint, let's talk about what changed when net neutrality rules were put in place in 2015. What did those regulations require beyond the things that we've been talking about that, that are no longer regulated? Was that it?
Well, those are the main things. There were a few other things that get a little bit more complex and esoteric in terms of giving the FCC some authority to intervene in deals that internet service providers make with each other, essentially behind the scenes. But the big things were the rules about blocking, slowing down, or allowing companies to pay extra money to prioritize their services.
So by 2015, I think it's fair to argue that the majority of Americans had been online for 20 years. Why did it take such a long time to put those rules in place in the first place?
Well, the first attempt at putting some rules around net neutrality came actually back in 2005 when the FCC passed a policy statement just saying that internet service providers couldn't block lawful content. So it's been a legal battle ever since then. Comcast ended up suing the FCC in, I believe, 2008 or 2009 over that earlier rule. And then the FCC made a new set of rules in 2010. AT&T took them to court over those. I'm sorry, actually, it was Verizon took them to court over those. And they got thrown out. And so then we ended up with the 2015 rules. So it's not exactly that net neutrality rules are new. There's been some sort of net neutrality rules on the books off and on since 2005.
Were internet service providers losing money under net neutrality rules, or were they losing maybe potential revenue?
It would be more on the side of potential revenue. The companies, you know, I mean, it varies from quarter to quarter, but mm-hmm. They weren't, you know, hurting from these regulations. But you know, they did want to try to make money by essentially charging a company like Netflix or Google, which owns YouTube, you know, extra money to deliver all the video that they deliver to customers. And their argument is that people are watching more and more video, they're consuming more and more data, and they don't want to pay more for their internet connections. So they need to find new ways to make money, to make revenue, to put into infrastructure for supporting all this data.
And I've heard that argument that companies like, you know, YouTube and Netflix were almost getting a free ride before. Is that reasonable?
So the thing there is that they are still paying for their connectivity. What these companies wanted to do, what Comcast and Verizon and not necessarily Comcast, Verizon was a little more explicit about wanting to do this. What their idea is more of trying to I guess charge on both sides of the transaction. So maybe an analogy with a post office would help here. So if you want to mail a package to someone, you pay at the post office, and then they just get the package. You know, they don't have to pay again once they receive it. So the paid prioritization idea is a little bit like that. So but sort of in reverse, the consumer is already paying for their internet connection, and actually. The companies like Netflix are also paying for their connections, but the internet service providers would like to charge the Netflixes of the world essentially twice. Once to have the data leave their data centers, and then once to have it arrive in your home. If that makes any sense.
Yeah. So did internet service providers have to change the way they'd been doing business already after 2015? Or were the rules more like a preventive measure against the possibility that ISPs might start doing this double-dip postal system in their delivery of content?
It was more of a preventative measure, though there had been some examples of internet service providers blocking or slowing down content. So the thing that triggered the Comcast lawsuit in 2008 happened when the FCC ordered Comcast to stop slowing down BitTorrent traffic. And there was also an instance in around 2009 or 10 where AT&T was caught working out a deal with Apple to block Skype on iPhones.
Go ahead, please.
No, it was just, those are just a couple of basic examples of where this has come up before. But it wasn't a widespread practice. There wasn't any big major change that anyone had to make in order to comply with the rules.
Is it a technologically simple thing to achieve to block or slow certain content based on its origin? Is that something that they could, if they chose to, that these ISPs could turn on tomorrow?
I don't know. I mean, blocking seems pretty straightforward, and there companies have actually been doing that for a long time. You can see that with parental filters, for example. Trying to do more of the traffic shaping, the slowing down or speeding up content, I think is probably a little bit more technologically challenging. But we've already seen some companies do variations on this. For example, T-Mobile slows down video content by default for some subscription plans. Verizon has started to do the same thing as well.
So, Clint, the FCC Chairman Pai said the objections raised by consumers and smaller tech companies against the repeal of net neutrality were much ado about nothing. Is there evidence that the 2015 regulation created rules to fix a problem that didn't exist?
Well, not. I would argue no, just based off of what I mentioned already. We had seen Comcast slow down BitTorrent, though they deny that they were actually slowing it down, but... And, you know, we had the situation with Apple and AT&T blocking Skype. So it and Verizon in their arguments in court when they challenged the earlier net neutrality laws, they expressly said they wanted to be able to engage in paid prioritization arrangements. So, it's not nothing, but it is true that it wasn't a widespread practice before.
So right now, the big internet service providers, and I'm summarizing here, but they're saying, look, we didn't want this unnecessary regulation, but we're not intending to change anything, certainly from the perspective of consumers. They will get the internet as they always have if they continue paying for our service. Can we trust that this will be true for a long time?
Not really. And you've already seen them, we've already seen them sort of backpedal a little bit, where ahead of the FCC vote, they were more explicit about saying we're not going to block or throttle or allow paid prioritization. And they've backpedaled on the paid prioritization part. Comcast actually removed that from a web page that had their sort of net neutrality pledge on it. And they claim, you know, they say they don't have any plans to engage in paid prioritization right now, but they've, you know, they're not promising not to in the future at this point. And you see that in a lot of these cases that they're not willing to outright say that they're never going to do paid prioritization.
My guest is journalist Clint Finley. He writes for Wired magazine about telecommunications and technology law. We're talking about how the end of net neutrality could change the way we interact online. If you've got a question about this, we invite you to call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or get to us via Twitter. We are @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Wired magazine journalist Clint Findlay about the end of net neutrality and how it could change the way we live online. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send us a tweet. We're at KERATHINK. Clint, let's say it's 10 years from now, net neutrality is not reinstated. ISPs are behaving in the way a lot of people think they will. Are they required to tell us when they're not serving up data to consumers in a content-neutral way?
Yeah, that is actually one of the only things that is going to still be on the books from the current FCC order is a disclosure requirement that if a company decides to do some of these things, they have to disclose it somewhere. So again, though, it's hard to know exactly what that would look like, and it depends on what the companies end up deciding to do, and it could end up being, you know, buried in fine print. So I think it could end up being fairly difficult to determine exactly what ends up happening.
One would think that competition would be helpful. You know, if you have three internet service providers to choose from and, you know, you're able to deduce the one that serves you up Netflix the fastest or YouTube, you choose that one. But lots of parts of America, people don't have a choice.
Yeah, that's a big problem. And there's some amount of movement, you know, going to try to have cities start their own internet service providers, or have utility companies, usually state-owned or city-owned utilities, start offering internet access to compete with the big cable companies. But, you know, it's still pretty slim pickings out there.
We've also heard that a number of states are exploring their options for creating their own net neutrality statutes. What's involved with that? Is it an easy thing for states to regulate something like this?
No. So the part of the problem right now is that the new FCC order actually explicitly overrules state regulations on net neutrality. So they're essentially saying that states aren't allowed to do this. So the states that do end up trying to bring some sort of net neutrality rules, so we've California and Washington are both looking at this. Those states could well end up in court with the FCC. The two that I just mentioned, I know part of what they're trying to do, though, is maybe skirt the FCC's rules by not necessarily saying you have that it's illegal for ISPs to not follow net neutrality, but to essentially make life harder for internet service providers who don't follow net neutrality. For example, make it harder for them to access telephone poles or utility poles so that it's harder for them to conduct business that way, or removing government contracts that they may have. So doing things like that to encourage them to engage with net neutrality.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or go to Twitter and send a question to @KERATHINK. First up, we have Shahzad calling from Dallas. Hi, Shahzad.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Clint. Just my question was regarding, is there anything that you see that the internet users can actually do now proactively before having some kind of negative impact on their habits of how they use the internet? So is there anything that they need to be doing right now, or is it already too late? It's completely out of the user's hands.
Thanks for your call.
The big thing you can do right now is talk to your representatives in Congress, your senators, your House of Representatives rep, because this is going to be coming up to a congressional vote sometime in the future. There are at least two plans sort of floating around in Congress right now. One, it would actually just cancel the new FCC order, which would essentially force them to keep the net neutrality rules that already exist. And the other is a proposal that would implement some really basic weak net neutrality rules. I think basically just banning blocking, but not banning other types of, not banning paid prioritization and that sort of thing, and severely limiting the FCC's future authority to pass those sort of rules.
When the
so
FCC
there's kind of
oh go
yeah,
ahead
go ahead. There's one that's a very hard move that the Democrats are pushing to preserve net neutrality, and then the other is coming from Republicans to kind of push a very weak compromise.
Well, I'm glad you brought this up because this is what I wanted to ask you about. When the FCC board was set to vote on this repeal, there was lots of reporting about the fact that the FCC currently has a Republican majority. Why has this shaken out as a red-blue issue when presumably Americans of all political stripes use the internet? Why is this an issue that falls on party lines?
Yeah, it's a little strange, to be honest, because the polling shows that that both Republican and Democratic voters want net neutrality rules on the books. But it's become hyper-polarized in the Senate and in the FCC. Nonetheless, a lot of people point to lobbying, but the big telecommunications companies, they actually do give a lot of money to Democrats as well as Republicans. So it's hard to blame that entirely for the Republican position. Some of it probably comes down to a certain amount of ideology in terms of just being opposed to government regulation in general. And I think some of it is just a matter of the old FCC rules came under the Obama presidency. They came from an FCC chairman who was appointed by Obama, and the Republicans are really just trying to undo that entire legacy, regardless of whether the ideas are good or not.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time, Lisa is calling us from Garland. Hi, Lisa.
Hello, everyone. My question was that I noticed right after net neutrality was reversed that this one particular website that I frequent to stream some content was severely blocked up. And the website is the Internet Archive or the Wayback Machine. And it just would not load, or I'd use another browser and it would load slower. I contacted the website, found out other people were having the same issue, and my next step was going to the FCC or whoever to complain about this. So what I want to find out is this the type of thing that the average user is going to see when going to certain websites and they'll notice a difference, but not all websites?
Thank you so much for your call, Lisa. I guess she's asking, is this happening already maybe, but we're not talking about it?
Well, yeah, I don't think that it's likely that your internet service provider was deliberately slowing down the Wayback Machine or the Internet Archive, because the net neutrality rules are still on the books, but for at least a couple more months. But that is the sort of thing you might that is the way it might manifest itself. The end of net neutrality is that you would go to something like the Internet Archive that doesn't have the budget of Google or Netflix to strike a deal with internet service providers, and then you would find that they are running much more slowly, or that the video streams have become choppy. Or the other side of this is that maybe, and I think this is actually a little bit more likely, that today's video quality streams will stay roughly the same, that there won't be a push towards making internet connections so slow that you can't stream video from the companies that you choose, but future higher resolution video quality will be restricted to select partners, so that some people will be stuck essentially in 2017. Some providers will be stuck in 2017, but in 2025, when something new comes along the big companies, Netflix, Google, the companies that can pay to get priority access, will be able to upgrade to those new video technologies.
Okay, I want to talk about some of the arguments that I've heard in favor of allowing internet companies to prioritize certain things. If you or I go to the emergency room and we have a sprained ankle, we assume that we will be taken in the order in which we have arrived unless somebody comes in who's having a heart attack. We sort of get that that's an emergency situation and it becomes more important than our sprained ankle. Now that we're thinking about a future with lots of autonomous cars counting on GPS directions that are processed on servers all over the country, is it reasonable that internet companies might serve up that information to get someone somewhere safely ahead of like cooking videos or sports highlights?
Yeah, so there's actually some provisions in the 2015 rules for those types of situations. One is that the rules don't cover data connection services that aren't the internet. So it's still possible for, say, Verizon to offer a wireless service that's specifically for cars. It doesn't offer the whole internet. It just offers GPS and directions and things that are specific to offering a car service, a car-related connected car service. Likewise, the telemedicine services could operate in the same way, but they wouldn't go over the open internet, the standard internet. They would actually be able to have their own separate connections, so there wouldn't be any routing issues or prioritization issues. There is also there's also language in the rules that allow commercially reasonable network management, and so that has never really been challenged in court to find out what the limitations there are, but. That could potentially give internet service providers some leeway to allow telemedicine or certain kind of high priority things to operate without being interfered with by cat videos or whatever.
We're talking about the end of net neutrality with journalist Clint Finley of Wired magazine. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, I want to go to the phones once again. This time we have Mike calling us from Frisco. Hi, Mike.
Hi, guys. How are you doing today?
Very well, thanks.
Excellent. Great show, as always, Chris.
Thanks.
So I wanted to ask your guest, is it even possible nowadays for an individual or group of individuals to essentially create their own ISP? And I'm talking about independent of local governments or state governments, or just if I and some friends wanted to create a company and said, we're going to call ourselves, Neutral Net ISP. Is it even possible for that to happen given the current situation? And I'm thinking back to some cell phone companies popped up, when the big three kind of started getting some competition. Is there a share the infrastructure policy or process in place for that kind of situation?
Hmm. It is possible. It would be expensive and difficult, especially if you wanted to offer, cable or fiber internet, because that involves what people call the last mile, actually bringing cables into people's homes. That's a really expensive proposition. Wireless internet is more feasible. There are a number of fairly small wireless internet companies that serve smaller communities, that serve rural communities often. And essentially, they'll go out, they'll buy a tower and an antenna, and buy a connection from essentially an internet wholesaler that has a fiber optic backbone near them that they can tap into and connect that antenna to. So it's possible. I don't know exactly what it would cost. I mean, you would definitely need some deep-pocketed investors to do it, but it's within the realm of possibility.
Are these small startup internet service providers helped by the repeal of net neutrality in the same way that presumably very large carriers are?
So smaller carriers have been divided on this. Smaller wireless providers, I think. There was a letter that was sent to the FCC in support of repealing the net neutrality rules that was signed by a bunch of wireless small wireless internet service companies. So they wanted to see the rules go away because they were worried that additional regulations would increase their overhead and discourage investors from giving them money to buy more towers, to set up more broadcast stations, that sort of thing. But there was also a letter that was sent by a smaller number of small companies, but still a couple dozen at least, I think, smaller companies that said no, the net neutrality rules are fine. That's not, those don't create the barriers to investment that we have, and in a way they help actually level the playing field for smaller companies, because these smaller companies, they're not going to be able to get somebody like Google or Facebook to shell out paid prioritization money to, you know, just a tiny internet service company, say in rural East Texas. They're just not going to be able to get a meeting with Google. So they'll be on more of a level playing field if those types of arrangements are just not even allowed.
Please correct me if I've got this wrong, but I seem to remember reporting that AT&T cut some of its infrastructure investment after the new net neutrality rules were enacted in 2015.
Yeah, though they had already planned on doing that. They had just spent a bunch of money upgrading their cellular network to 4G. And so they had warned, I think, as far back as 2012, maybe earlier, that in 2015 they would spend less money on infrastructure.
So it wasn't necessarily a response to these new rules.
No, I've looked at this pretty extensively, and there's not any compelling evidence that the rules themselves curbed investment in infrastructure. Some companies ended up spending more money, Comcast, for example.
How closely are legislators following this issue? Do they get the stakes here?
I think so. It's becoming a bigger and bigger issue. I mean, it's somewhat comical, but you know, Mark Hamill, the Star Wars star, got into a little bit of a back and forth with Ted Cruz and Donald Trump Jr. on Twitter the weekend that Last Jedi opened. So I mean, we're seeing, you know, some of the biggest stars in the country engaging with high-level politicians on Twitter on this issue. It's a topic that's definitely getting a lot of attention now.
My guest is journalist Clint Finley. He writes about internet law for Wired magazine. We're talking about how the end of net neutrality could affect the way we interact online. If you'd like to join us, we will take more of your questions after the break. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Clint Finley of Wired magazine. We're talking about the end of net neutrality and how it could change the way we live online and the way companies do business online. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372. Clint, what effect might the repeal have, if any, on the way content creators and aggregators do business? Would they potentially make different decisions about what they put on the web? Would they find ways to charge users of this content for subscriptions rather than serving it up free?
I don't know. I think one of the main effects this would have, though, is that it would consolidate the power that companies like Google already have in terms of reach. So today, a lot of news organizations that do video online, they put their content on YouTube instead of on their own servers, and they're really at the mercy of Google to keep that content online, to promote it or not promote it, do their algorithms. So that if it becomes more expensive for a journalistic outfit to publish their own video on their own servers, that gives them even more incentive to use something like YouTube or Facebook Video instead of their own platform. So it puts more and more control into fewer and fewer hands.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we'll speak with Terrence in Austin. Hi, Terrence.
Hello. Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just heard you mention Google, and that's been my question all along, is with a company like Google or Microsoft, two juggernauts with deep pockets, isn't there an opportunity for them to build out an infrastructure and take a large portion of the market share based on the fact that, you know, we typically perceive these as progressive companies who would, and as a matter of fact, they have embraced preserving net neutrality. Wouldn't it be an opportunity for them to say, okay, we're going to build out the Google fiber network? I read an article, as a matter of fact, in Wired magazine about Microsoft building out a UHF frequency internet. So couldn't they say, hey, if these other companies are going to try to squeeze you on the data, come over to our network and we're going to, you know, bulldoze, take over the market.
All right, let's find out. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I mean, the problem there is that Google has already kind of started to slow down their investment in Google Fiber. They've described it in other terms, saying that they are reconsidering how best they want to reach consumers. But the long and short of it is that they are focusing more on wireless and not on fiber anymore. I'm not even sure how aggressively they're pursuing wireless anymore, to be honest. Microsoft's work that you mentioned in essentially television white space is more of a technological experiment in rural areas. And I don't know how seriously they take that as a process to actually compete with the big companies. So we'll have to see what actions they take in that regard. But as I said earlier, it's just really expensive to start a new internet service provider, which Google has experienced firsthand with Google Fiber. So it's it's not necessarily something that's in their wheelhouse as companies.
All right, next we go to Nabil calling from Dallas. Hi, Nabil.
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to ask, so if net neutrality were to end and, say, people in smaller towns or areas only have access to one internet provider, which may be like Verizon or Comcast or a company that does promote or support a net neutrality ending, what would those people be able to do?
Again, I think the main thing they would be able to do is talk to their representatives at the state level and at the federal level, and encourage a change in the laws.
So Congress could pass a law that takes the authority to enact or repeal such rules away from the FCC. Is that it?
They could do that, or they could pass a straight net neutrality law that just says that this is the actual new law of the land. They have the authority to do that, and you know they would have to get the president to sign it, which is a whole nother ball of wax. But that's where the meat of this debate is moving.
Okay, let's say that Internet service provider X actually goes ahead with changing the way it delivers content based on the source, or it blocks certain content or slows things. If ISP X is blocking competitors, could it face antitrust action?
Yes, that would be another avenue. If they're in a small town and their internet service provider starts to behave in a way they don't like, they can file a complaint with the Federal Trade Commission, and hope that that problem falls within their authority. Part of the problem there is that the FTC doesn't have the authority to make rules; they only enforce rules. Whereas the FCC can actually make rules in advance, so they can actually say no blocking, no throttling, no pay prioritization. The FTC, on the other hand, is in a position where they can only act on rules that already exist. So if there aren't rules against blocking or throttling, then they have to resort to looking at other rules, namely antitrust laws, to look and say, well, is this company abusing its market power to negatively affect a competitor? And so the worry is that there's going to be a lot of net neutrality cases that don't really fall into a traditional antitrust situation. And then also it will take a really long time to resolve those sort of antitrust issues. Whereas with the FCC rules, where there's what they call a bright line rule, just a specific rule that says don't do this, then everyone knows what to expect and what not to do. Whereas with a looser interpretation where you're only looking at antitrust, the courts could end up deciding either way on a particular issue.
All right,
so there's a lot less certainty for consumers.
All right, let's hear from Houston now. We have Walter on the line there. Hi, Walter.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So my understanding is that the argument the ISPs make is that it doesn't make sense for them to invest in infrastructure for high bandwidth uses like, you know, Netflix or whatever. What I don't understand is why they don't put that on consumers and say, if I'm a high bandwidth user, if I'm streaming a lot of video, I pay more for my internet service. If I'm using less of that expensive bandwidth, maybe I pay less. And rather than having individual server or having individual content providers pay the extra, put that on the person who's actually using that data.
Thanks, Walter. That's certainly the way it works for a lot of people with cell phone service.
Right. And Comcast already has a data cap now of 1 terabyte. So if you use more than 1 terabyte per month of data, then you have to pay extra. But part of the issue there is just that I think these companies are realizing that there's only so much that consumers can or will pay for internet access. And in a lot of cases, they're already pretty close to that limit. So they're looking for ways to make more money that don't involve increasing people's bills any further than they've already been increased.
Is it not getting technologically cheaper to provide bandwidth in the same way that computer memory has become less expensive?
I'm not entirely sure about that. I believe that in many cases, yes. And that's also that speaks to some of the infrastructure issues as well, that companies have found ways to actually expand their capacity that don't cost as much as they used to. So they can save a little bit of money there.
We have a tweet here from Daniel who writes, big ISPs try to stop smaller ISPs from growing by taking them to court over small things as a delay tactic. Both sides know it's a delay tactic. I don't know if you agree or disagree with that statement or can tell us how that relates to what we're talking about, Clint.
Well, there are some examples of that happening. I believe it was Louisville, Kentucky, where one of the large telecommunications companies tried to stop Google Fiber from coming in. I think they didn't sue Google Fiber directly. They sued the city to try to essentially, to make a long story short, they were just trying to keep Google Fiber from being able to get priority access to utility poles to string their cables. And you know, one expects to see that sort of behavior in other places as well. And that does keep, you know, a monopoly or helps maintain a monopoly power for the bigger companies, which affects net neutrality in the sense that, you know, it would be more likely that companies would not behave in anti-competitive or less consumer-friendly ways if they had to compete with each other.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Let's speak now with Richard in Austin. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I'm just wondering how VPNs, virtual private networks, and the like, you know, the provider on this end and the provider on that end don't necessarily even see anything going by or know where it comes from. Also, if, for instance, Netflix were situated in Spain instead of in the United States, you know, how they would go about making a contract to get money from them.
Okay. So on the VPN side, I do personally recommend using VPN services for privacy, especially if you're on like a public Wi-Fi network. I have a VPN service. I use it. But I don't think it's a real solution to this problem for a few reasons. One, that your internet service provider could block or throttle your VPN service and just make it so that anything you're trying to connect to over the VPN is slower. Just the VPN connection itself could be made slower or just blocked outright. Part of the other problem is that on the other end of the equation, there are companies that block connections from VPNs, like Netflix. If you have a VPN, you have to turn it off in order to connect to Netflix. So that creates some complications there. But it could ease some net neutrality issues insofar as, yeah, your internet connection, your internet provider won't be able to see what you're connecting to, and therefore they won't be able to slow it down, at least so as long as they don't slow the VPN connection itself down. And that could also be a good way to get around blocked sites, assuming the VPN itself isn't blocked. In terms of the overseas contracts, I'm not an international law expert, but companies make contracts and legal arrangements across country borders all the time.
The Associated Press reported last week that FCC Chairman Ajit Pai did not attend the Consumer Electronics Show as planned because he was receiving death threats over this net neutrality stuff. Obviously, there are people who are deeply upset about this ruling. I wonder, though, is this a big enough concern for average voters to be a real factor in midterm elections later this year?
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see, what action Congress takes before the midterms. But people are definitely, like I mentioned, it's the word is really getting out there now. When you have Mark Hamill arguing with Ted Cruz and Donald Trump Jr. on Twitter about it. So that I think part of the question, though, is there's so many big issues that are going to be involved in the midterms. There's healthcare. There's the tax bill. There's so many big issues right now that it is possible that net neutrality will get a little bit lost in the shuffle. I think a lot of Republican politicians are not going to particularly expect to lose voters over net neutrality if their competition is a fairly traditional Democrat. So we'll really have to wait and see. But I think it's going to at least be a minor issue in the midterms.
Do the courts have the authority to override FCC policy?
Yes, and that's another thing that could happen here. There's already lawsuits planned to try to overturn the new FCC ruling. Essentially, federal law prohibits federal agencies from passing arbitrary or capricious regulations. So since these rules, the 2015 rules are so new, to have them just completely flip in just 2 years' time could be considered capricious. So we'll see how that plays out.
Clint Finley writes for Wired magazine about telecommunications and technology law. You can find his work at wired.com. Clint, thank you so much for making time to explain all this to us.
Hey, thanks again for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @KERAThink. Find the podcast and archives of the show at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.